at Contra Podcast Conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Contra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into one of the 20th century's most profound and frankly, often really misunderstood conflicts, the Mexican Revolution, that whole chaotic decade from, what, 1910 to about 1920?
Exactly. And we're tackling this huge event through the eyes of Alan Knight. His two-volume history is, well, pretty much the definitive account. And, you know, this is essential stuff because Knight argues very persuasively, I think, that this wasn't just some political squabble or, like, a coup. It was fundamental social change driven right from the ground up.
Yeah, understanding this helps you understand modern Mexico for sure, but also, like, modern governance everywhere. How states get forged in chaos, how popular demands can just swamp elite political goals, the real power of, you know, people getting organized.
Right. So let's talk about Knight himself for a second. He's this really distinguished historian, Oxford professor. His work is just foundational. But what makes his take so different, so groundbreaking?
It really comes down to his method, doesn't it? Knight is all about social history. Most histories before him were focused on the great men, you know, the generals, the presidents, the political players in the capital. Knight, he did the really hard yards, digging through local archives, regional records. He wanted to know what was happening down in Morelos or up in Chihuahua, not just what the guys in Mexico City were saying.
Mm-hmm. He prioritized the experiences of ordinary people, the peasants who'd lost their land, the ranch hands, the factory workers who basically had no political voice. And this bottom-up approach, it gave him this critical distance. It let him strip away a lot of the kind of nationalist myths, you know, the heroic stories that often get wrapped around official histories.
Okay, so he's reframing the whole thing. What's the core idea then? Is he saying the leaders we all know, like Madero or Carranza, that they weren't actually important?
Oh, no, they were important, definitely. But he argues their importance is, well, often way overstated. Knight says the national leaders were frequently just reacting to this massive, spontaneous, really powerful wave of popular action that they barely controlled, certainly didn't create it. The people, the masses, they were the real engine here, forcing the elites to constantly respond and adapt.
Right. That sets up his main argument nicely. Knight's big thesis is that the Mexican Revolution wasn't simple, wasn't neat. It was a genuine, complex, multi-layered social revolution.
Exactly. And it tackles that huge question. Did it actually create lasting structural change? Or was it just, you know, a decade of violence that ended up putting new faces on the same old power structures? Knight says, emphatically, no, it was real change. It altered social, economic, political structures forever.
So he's pushing back against that simple single story. He calls it a pluralistic and often contradictory tapestry, meaning countless local struggles that sort of bubbled up and converged into this national chaos. Not one revolution, maybe hundreds of little ones all tangled together.
Yeah, and that leads to the huge paradox he keeps coming back to. This massive popular uprising, often deeply anti-state, right? People wanting local control. But it ultimately resulted in not local autonomy, but the creation of a new, much more powerful, much more centralized national state. The fight against the state actually ended up building a stronger state. Weird, huh?
That is a twist. So how did it all kick off? Let's go back to the beginning. The dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz, the Porfiriato, lasted from 1876 to 1911. Everyone knows he brought modernization, railways, stability, but Knight highlights how brittle that stability really was.
Totally brittle. Because Diaz pushed for economic growth and stability, but at a huge social cost. Knight points to three key pressure points that eventually just exploded. First, and maybe most important, the agrarian grievances.
Okay, let's nail that down. What does that mean specifically, the agrarian grievances?
It was this systematic process where peasant communities were losing their traditional communal land holdings, their ejidos. These were being swallowed up by massive private estates, the haciendas, which were expanding like crazy, often with government backing. So you get this huge population of landless, deeply resentful rural people who'd lost their traditional way of life.
That sounds explosive.
Yeah.
What was the second tension?
Political centralization. Diaz basically hollowed out local and regional power. He put his own loyal guys in charge everywhere, replacing local bosses and governors. This ticked off not just the peasants, but also powerful regional elites and the new middle classes who felt totally shut out of any real power.
Right, makes sense. And the third?
Social dislocation. As Mexico modernized under Diaz, it created new groups, industrial workers in factories, and urban middle class. But the political system was rigid, it hadn't evolved. These new groups had aspirations, but no political voice, and often their old economic roles were disappearing. The system just couldn't absorb them.
So the pressure cooker is building. And then comes Francisco Madero, 1910 to 1913, the wealthy idealist who lights the fuse. His goal was actually pretty limited, right? A political revolution.
Yeah, purely political. Liberal democracy. Yeah. His famous slogan, effective suffrage, no re-election. He wanted to change the rules of the game at the very top, clean up the elections, basically.
But here's Knight's crucial point, that disconnect. The millions who answered Madero's call, they weren't fired up about abstract political rights. They wanted a social revolution.
Exactly. They wanted land back. They wanted justice. They wanted local autonomy, concrete things. Madero was, well, politically naive, perhaps. Once he got power, he failed completely to deliver serious land reform or tackle those deep structural problems.
And that failure doomed him. Big mistake keeping the old Porfirian army around. They turned on him, murdered him in 1913. And his failure kicks off the next phase, the Great Rebellion, 1913 to 1915. This is the most radical, most social phase. All these different popular groups uniting against the conservative counter-revolution led by Victoriano Huerta.
This is the real messy heart of the revolution. And it's where Knight brings in his key way of analyzing things. He distinguishes between the two main types of popular movements that made up the revolution's mass base. First, you've got the Zapatistas down in the south, mostly in Morelos.
Right, and Knight calls them the agraristas. Let's unpack that term. What defined them?
They were these cohesive, disciplined peasant communities. They wanted something very specific, land restitution. Getting their ejido lands back. They were essentially defensive, focused on their land, their village, their local community, and they had a clear program, the Plan de Ayala.
So fighting to restore a traditional way of life that was being destroyed.
Precisely. Now contrast that with the Balistas up in the north. Knight calls them the Serranos.
The Serranos, how are they different?
More mobile people, often more individualistic communities. Ranchers, free villagers, people from military colonies on the frontier. They were fighting more for local and regional autonomy from the central state, defending their individual freedoms and independence from Mexico City's control.
Okay, so Villa's Division of the North, that famous army, was huge, right? A powerful force.
Oh, massive. A formidable fighting force. But their political program wasn't as focused or specific as Zapata's. It was more about general autonomy, a kind of populist nationalism. They weren't necessarily fighting for communal ejido land reform in that same targeted way. And that difference in goals and structure turns out to be really crucial.
So you have these two massive popular forces, Villa's army, Zapata's movement with its moral authority. But ultimately, Knight says, they were both defeated by the third major faction, the constitutionalists, led by Venustiano Carranza and his top general, Alvaro Obregón. How did they pull it off? How did they beat Villa and Zapata?
They won because they were, well, politically smarter and strategically more adaptable. First off, they immediately grabbed control of the port of Veracruz. Why does that matter?
Customs revenues. Money.
Exactly. Money. Controlling Veracruz meant they had the cash flow to buy modern weapons from abroad, machine guns, artillery. They could professionalize their army, while Villa and Zapata were largely stuck with what they could capture or make themselves.
And Obregón, the general, he was key too.
Absolutely key. Obregón was a tactical innovator. Knight really emphasizes this. He understood modern warfare.
Yeah.
He used trenches, barbed wire, machine guns, basically World War I tactics to just shatter Villa's legendary cavalry charges. The big battles in the Bajío region, especially Celaya in 1915, that was it. Romantic heroism versus industrial warfare. Industrial warfare won, decisively.
So the constitutionalists win the military struggle. And then they consolidate their victory. How?
With the Constitution of 1917. This becomes the revolution's lasting institutional legacy. It wasn't the pure anarchist or agrarian dream of the popular forces, not at all. But it was the constitutionalist pragmatic compromise.
And it was pretty radical for its time, wasn't it, socially speaking?
Oh, yeah. It cleverly absorbed the language of the popular movements. It enshrined land reform. Article 27 is huge, vesting subsoil resources in the nation, promising land redistribution. And Article 123 brought in really comprehensive labor rights and protections. So the state basically acknowledged and, crucially, co-opted the key popular demands into its own framework.
Okay, let's pull back then. What are the really big themes, the main takeaways from Knight's whole analysis?
Number one, definitely, is the primacy of popular agency. The revolution wasn't just handed down from above. It was driven by millions of ordinary people fighting for very concrete interests: land, water, local power, not just, abstract ideologies.
That's huge. It means if you really want to understand big changes, you've got to look at the grassroots, not just the leaders in the capital. And the second theme follows from that, right? The regional diversity.
Exactly. It was a revolution of many revolutions. The Zapatistas' organized fight for land in the south was fundamentally different from the Villistas' fight for autonomy in the north. This diversity was maybe their strength against Diaz initially, but it became a fatal weakness later on. They couldn't unite effectively to govern after 1915.
And the third big theme, that paradox you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, that profound paradoxical outcome. The revolution's most lasting achievement wasn't Zapata's or Villa's vision winning out. It was the creation of a powerful, modern Mexican state under the very constitutionalists who defeated them.
That's the ultimate irony. This new state learned how to use the language, the symbols, even the heroes of the popular movements, like putting Zapata on murals decades later, to basically legitimize its own centralized rule, which led, eventually, to the long dominance of the PRI party.
They built their power on the very movements that wanted to tear down central power. It's a masterclass in political co-option.
Wait, hold on. So are you saying Zapata and Villa ultimately failed because they got the exact opposite of what they wanted, a stronger central state instead of local autonomy? That sounds incredibly harsh.
Well, Knight argues that institutionally, yes, they failed to achieve their primary goal of local power. But socially, you could argue they succeeded, because their relentless pressure forced the constitutionalists to write that revolutionary constitution in 1917. That document, even if implemented imperfectly, set the legal framework for a potentially more equitable society, even if it was a centralized one. So maybe the popular forces lost the war but kind of won the long-term legal battle, or at least shaped it significantly.
That's a really interesting nuance. Okay, Knight's work is massive, but he has some great summarizing ideas. Let's share a few key concepts that really stick with you.
Yeah, first, summing up his whole approach. The Mexican Revolution was not one single event, but a complex process of social transformation that unfolded differently across Mexico's diverse regions. That's him pushing back hard against oversimplification.
Right. And second, on why Madero failed so badly. Madero offered the Mexican people democracy, but they sought not abstract rights, but tangible justice, land, autonomy, and relief from oppression. That just perfectly captures the gap between elite politics and popular needs in a crisis.
Mm-hmm. And finally, nailing that paradoxical outcome. The ultimate and paradoxical triumph of the revolution was the creation of a new, more powerful, and more resilient national state, a state that learned to speak the language of revolution in order to consolidate its own power. That's the core twist.
So this dive into history nearly a century ago, it actually has some pretty striking relevance for you, the listener, today. Especially when you watch conflicts or social movements playing out now.
Yeah, definitely. One clear application is understanding social movements and governance. Knight's contrast between Villa, the charismatic military leader, and Obregón, the pragmatic institution builder, it shows you something crucial. Insurgency, winning battles, that's one skill set. Political organization, building stable institutions, governing day to day, that's completely different. And lots of modern movements, even successful ones, stumble badly at that transition, from fighting to ruling.
It's also a huge cautionary tale for leaders, isn't it? Look at Diaz. He focused solely on economic growth, modernization, keeping investors happy, while totally ignoring the rising inequality and the fact that people had no say. Stability, whether it's 1910 Mexico or anywhere today, it's just an illusion if you let popular grievances fester under the surface. You can't just focus on the economy and ignore the social fabric.
Absolutely. And finally, it's a great spur for critical thinking about national myths. Knight really forces you to look under the hood of any country's official story about its defining moments. Find the messy, complex, often contradictory reality that was forged by ordinary people, not just the heroes on the statues. Don't just accept the official narrative.
You know, what really stands out to me is that profound sense that the Mexican people themselves, the Aguiristas, the Serranos, they were the real protagonists here. Their long, messy, decentralized struggle is what forced the change, even if the end result wasn't exactly what they dreamed of. Mm-hmm. Knight just gives you this incredible picture of how complex and human these huge transformations are.
And what fascinates me most is that political skill of the constitutionalists. Understanding that power isn't just about crushing your enemies, it's about absorbing their demands, their language, into your own system. That ability to co-opt radical energy to actually strengthen the central state. That's a political move you see again and again right up to today. A really powerful lesson in how institutions manage change.
Yeah, it really makes you think. Which modern nation's big founding story or revolutionary moment is maybe wrapped up in official myths that a future Alan Knight might one day carefully take apart? Something to chew on.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.